Thank you for joining us. I'm Scott Atlas. Welcome to The Independent, my show that tries to bring a rational perspective to some of society's most important issues. Today's guest is Aaron Cyberium, one of the star journalists representing a new group of young reporters committed to restoring the critical role of true investigative reporting. He's a reporter at the Washington Free Beacon, where he's broken several critical stories exposing things like fraud and malfeasance at our so-called elite universities. He graduated from one of them, Yale University, where he was the opinion editor of the Yale Daily News. And I'm proud to say Aaron is one of the members of the bold, young, rising leaders of the Global Liberty Institute, an international policy initiative formed to restore liberty and the free exchange of ideas. Aaron and I have a conversation about the state of America's journalism today, his journey and motivation in reporting truth. So thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, welcome, Aaron Cyberium.
Thank you for having me.
Great to see you here. You know, we have a lot to cover. I want to talk a lot about you and your pathway into what I call investigative journalism, which is a lost art. But before we get into some of your very impactful reporting that you've done, uncovering scandals, fraudulent research, fraudulent scholarship, in the leaders of some of our most elite institutions, and all these other things, let's start out with why are you interested? What made you motivated to become what I call a reporter?
Well, the short and simple answer is basically just that my boss asked me to do it, and I thought, oh, what the hell, I'll give it a try, and then it turned out I was pretty good at it. The longer answer is that I attended Yale University from 2014 to 2018, during which time Yale went through its own kind of cultural revolution. In a preview of what would happen in newsrooms around the country in 2020, the Yale Daily News kind of had its own internal struggle sessions during what became known as Halloween Costume Gate. This is the famous incident in which a mild email about cultural appropriation and Halloween costumes sparked months of protests at Yale University, including the head of Silliman College being circled in the courtyard by student activists and berated. As all that was going on, right, the Yale Daily News, where I worked, kind of was thrust into turmoil. There were struggle sessions, might be too strong a word, but there were meetings in which it became very clear that the editorial line of the paper was going to be, the protesters are wonderful, and if you disagree, you're out of here. And so I saw that up close from the inside. I was the opinion editor of the paper. And that experience, I would say, pushed me a bit to the right. I came into college a moderate Democrat. I came out of it not quite sure what I was. But it certainly left me scared of what we now call wokeness was going to do when it seeped out into the wider world.
If I can interrupt, you know what, it's fascinating to see, you know, many of us, including myself, are raised very socially liberal, but liberal politically and conservative politically when I was young meant something very different from what it's evolved into. But I think what hasn't changed is that journalism is not really traditionally pursued by high achieving young people. That's a blanket statement. Maybe it's just reflecting my own personal background. It's certainly not the highest paying field. It really has not been the most prestigious field for young people to enter. And that, I don't think, has changed over decades, despite what has now been uncovered, I think, in all of our awareness, that this is so important of a field. It's so right. Massively influential. And, you know, you mentioned you weren't really raised as a conservative, but you report many people would say you report on things that are so-called culture wars from the conservative side. So why is it, before we get into those specific things again, that there's so few young people going into journalism?
Right.
And why is it that there's far fewer on what would be called the conservative
sure.
side?
So I would, yeah, I would maybe modify your premise a bit and say, I actually think that from at a school like Yale, journalism is considered prestigious if it's journalism at the New York Times, the New Yorker, or the Washington Post, where, of course, Yale graduates do disproportionately end up. And that prestige, in fact, I think, is a kind of non-pecuniary compensation, right? They don't make as much money as law or finance, but they get the prestige of being a top New York Times reporter, and graduates from Yale like that. On the right, there's no kind of comparable prestige economy. So what you see is that the reality, or at least the perception among young conservatives who go to places like Yale and Harvard, and keep in mind that there aren't very many conservatives at those places to begin with, is that if you want to make money and have a lot of prestige, you go into law, right? You join the Federalist Society, you clerk for a Supreme Court judge, and then you make a bunch of money at a law firm. Or you go into finance, something like that. Conservative meat reporting publications in particular, for a long time have not been perceived as particularly prestigious. And the kind of default assumption, which is, I think, a bit overstated, but it's directionally accurate, is that right-wing media, you know, isn't a super well-paying profession. I think it's frankly better paying if you're good at it than people think, but it's not, you know, it's not law or finance. So it's hard to attract people to work at a place like the Washington Examiner, the Washington Free Beacon, you know, the Daily Caller even, at least people who are very talented and would actually be able to do the kind of investigative reporting for the right that the New York Times does for the left. And so I think in many cases, it requires a certain amount of personal motivation, a certain kind of inner drive to really fight back against and expose wokeism, to really want to go into right-wing investigative reporting. You have to kind of care about it for its own sake in order to do it.
Do you find that there are more people now? I mean, you're a trailblazer in my view. You've we'll get into some of the things that you've reported on, but you've really broken in the tradition of the old school investigative reporting. You've broken some stories that are really changing the way we discuss things in this country. And I wonder if you think this has been, if you've noticed, or maybe you don't have time to notice, you're busy working, other young people saying, you know, is this an inspiration, sort of a trend setting situation, if you can even have a perspective on that?
Sure. I mean, anecdotally, I've noticed a bit of a shift. I think there are more smart young people now on the right who've begun to realize that journalism, very broadly construed, can make a real difference. I mean, that's the first thing. They're seeing investigative reports like the one I did on Claudine Gay, or some of the stuff that Chris Rufo has done on Claudine Gay, as well as on critical race theory, drive discussion, shape policy, actually affect the real world in tangible ways. So in that sense, I think we're at the beginning maybe of kind of journalism becoming a more attractive profession for conservatives. But that process, if it's indeed occurring, is still at the very incipient stages. And what I notice is that you do see smart young people, including at places like Yale and Stanford, expressing maybe marginally more interest than they used to in conservative journalism, but there's still just a real pipeline problem, right? There are not enough people. People often will joke with me, we need 10 Aaron Sabarians. I'm like, yeah, it'd be great if we could find them. And I'm sure like the talent exists, but to convince the talented people to do this instead of something else, it's getting easier, but it's still difficult. And I think the bench on the right, the bench of talent for this stuff is just really quite thin compared to the bench of talent on the left. I think that's just the reality.
Yeah, but I think part of that, I want to make sure that that I understand as well as we're speaking sort of on the same basis. The bench of talent, meaning people already in journalism, but you know, as you know, and as I have seen in this Rising Leaders program in the Global Liberty Institute that you are one of the talented young people in, and I'm affiliated with that institute, is there's a lot of smart young people on this conservative side of things. And when I say conservative, I'm actually equating it with truth-seeking and fact-based, you know, objectiveness at some level. And that's a biased statement maybe, but I think there's a lot of young people. But the problem is, A, they're not going into journalism. That's one thing, and that's what you're talking about, the bench. But the second part is the sort of cancel culture in a broad sense. And we all know that exists. There's a tremendous amount of pressure on campus and in social circles about views that are sort of opposite to what the mainstream leftist view is. But I wonder more specifically how you're being treated by other journalists. And I'm not talking just about young journalists, and I'm saying journalists to encompass legacy type traditional media as well as social media, because you're active on both. And of course, this is the way things are leveraged. But how are you treated by other people in your generation in journalism, and also other journalists, even senior journalists?
Well, I mean, there's a split. I would say I'm treated better than you might expect from people both in my age group and older. I was the subject of a pretty positive profile in Politico magazine a few months ago. I think that says something, right? Politico didn't write a hit piece on me. It was fairly respectful, more than fairly respectful. I think it was actually
that's one of the ways we differ, I think. Our experience.
Yeah, no. I have not faced anything like the cancellation, right? You have. I will say, I also have had older reporters, including people, you know, I won't name names, but people at elite publications like the New York Times and Washington Post, who quietly, you know, tell me, yeah, you're doing great stuff. They read me. But look, all of these institutions have a kind of internal bifurcation where there are the good old fashioned journalists who just care about truth seeking. And then there's the more activist, we might even say NPR types, who've just been completely cannibalized by the ideology. So every so often, yeah, you know, there will be crazy people online who, like Nicole Hannah-Jones, sure, I've had some run-ins with, you know, who will express disdain. I frankly have escaped, I think, the brunt of the really bad cancellation. Part of that, though, is I think again, I don't mean to sound self-aggrandizing, but I think I genuinely do better, more bulletproof work than a lot of other journalists on my side, right? You have folks at the Washington Free Beacon where I work who are producing really good stuff that's fact-based, deeply reported, et cetera. It's not just me, right? But if you look at the broader ecosystem of right-wing journalists, there's quite a bit of, shall we say, shoddier work that's produced.
But I don't think that's just right-wing.
There's shoddy work
in journalism. The field has really disintegrated, in my view.
It's not. But because the left has sort of all the institutional power, any kind of error that a right-wing journalist makes just is subject to immense scrutiny, and it's not fair.
Absolutely.
Right? It's a double standard.
Yes,
the left
absolutely
should be subject to more scrutiny, but in practice it's not. And so, you know, one piece of advice
I give. The bar is very high. I always say, if you're going to speak against the conventional narrative, the accepted narrative, the dominant narrative, you cannot give low-hanging fruit for criticism. You can't make errors. You must be extremely accurate, extremely well-referenced, and extremely thorough in what you're saying, which, you know, we try to do, and you have done also. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've written about. And the first one you already mentioned, which is the former president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, and her plagiarism. I want to ask, A, in a simple way, sort of in general, how are you getting your information? This is sort of how does thorough investigative reporting work, particularly in an example like this, where the exposure of this fraud and the legitimacy of the process of even selecting these leaders cuts so thoroughly against the entire basis of the ideology of the people who hired the current leaders of these institutions. So how do you go about getting the information?
Well, part of the answer, frankly, is in you do this by being extremely careful not to divulge your sources so that people trust you and come to you with the information, right? But sure. More broadly, and of course, there's an effect where you break one story, it gets easier to break the next one because people learn your name. All of that's true and kind of intuitive common sense. I think the other thing, Claudine Gay was a very particular case because there was a ton of scrutiny on her, especially after that disastrous congressional hearing. There were lots of people, I think, who were in various ways looking for dirt on Claudine Gay. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out why. But in a lot of other cases, what happens is not that someone reaches out with a tip. This is how it works for me. I'll just get interested in something, or maybe I will get a tip. But then the tip will send me down a spiral of just Googling and research. And you just go spend enough time on the internet and you can find a lot of crazy things hiding in plain sight. For example, in early 2022, a lot of states were rationing access to monoclonal antibodies and the Pfizer antiviral Paxlovid based on race. And the states just put this on their government websites that they were, this is how their allocation schemes were. They gave extra points to BIPOC people. And effectively, the way the math worked out, you were, in essence, automatically penalized if you were white, and only if you were white. And this wasn't kept secret.
Sure. This happened with the vaccines, with the early vaccines.
Yes.
I mean, my own, you know, I always tell the story of my own mother-in-law who was 95 years old, living in Chicago area, couldn't get the vaccine. She wasn't in the priority group in 2021, and she was 95 years old. So I had to fly her to Florida, where there was a governor who said he's going to make common sense prioritization of the people who are high risk to die should be the ones who get protection from dying. So you're right. I mean, some of these things are so obvious.
Right.
They're just not reported. They're there. They're just not visible because they're not reported, because we have such a filtration going on of fact by, you know, unfortunately, the media who we depend on for the information. You know, so you're I believe that completely, is that these things are there for the taking if you just have the interest in finding truth, which is of course what investigative journalism was supposed to be and we thought was for the last half century or so. So some of these other things that you've uncovered, like the repeated research misconduct among DEI diversity program directors at the top universities, I think this is all under the sort of broader umbrella of the emperor's new clothes with elite universities in general. And I wonder, and a small question, how are you getting a lot of pushback and pressure from these elite universities because you're from one of them? I sort of wonder how that's working as a graduate of Yale. But more secondarily, what do you think's the projected sort of course of the elitism of elite universities, of the perceived excellence? Because I have my doubts that that will ever go away.
Yeah, so it's on the first question, look, I don't think Yale is going to be promoting me in an alumni magazine anytime soon. But what's striking to me is that many of these universities just refuse to engage with us. Maybe they'll give us a short statement confirming that a complaint of research misconduct was made. Maybe. Harvard has not done that any of the times I've contacted them. They've never once responded to a request for comment, and I've sent them quite a few at this point. A lot of times the tactic just seems to be ignore it and hope it goes away, and part of how they do that is by simply refusing to engage with conservative journalists. Don't actively attack me, they just kind of ignore me.
Right.
The second question about the elite status of these places, yeah, I tend to share your assessment. I think it's naive to believe that Hillsdale can become Harvard, or that Harvard will ever substantially lose its place as an incubator of elites. I do think that among the top schools, you could see some reshuffling of their relative ranking or status, right? The scandals at Harvard seem to have reduced applications to it this year. There was some early data indicating that, which, you know, that's something.
Right.
But overall,
is the more likely pathway, though, and I think you probably agree with me on this, is that the accountability, the exposing of these institutions will modify the way they operate to some extent. And I'm not sure that's naive. I hope it's not naive to say that there will be some objectivity in admissions. There will be some accountability for the scholarship of the people who are hired to be leaders.
Yeah.
We'll see, but
that's
what do you
hope.
Think about that?
I do think that some conservatives get too pessimistic about this because they actually underrate how much these places care about their own elite status. And the fact is that elite status comes in part from the widespread perception that they are incubators, not just of elites, but of genius. And so if the standards for, say, admissions are lowered too much to try to circumvent the affirmative action ban, say they just say, well, to get diversity, we're going to, you know, lower the SAT cutoff to, like, you know, 1,200 out of 1,600 at Harvard. Well, then the character of the institutions will change so rapidly and so visibly that it actually would harm their prestige to some extent. And I suspect they know that, which is why they aren't going to do that. And in fact, I suspect that's one reason that they've reinstated the SAT at a lot of these places in recent months. There's a balancing act where they know that they can't just totally throw out standards and maintain the kind of fig leaf of legitimacy.
Of course, some of it is the money and the funders, and I think we know that the power of influence of universities are the people who give the money to a great extent. The difficulty, of course, is that the people who give the money went to these schools. They don't necessarily want to undermine their own claim to elite status by degrading their own, you know, school that they graduate from. And of course, in my cynical side, I see it every day at Stanford. These same people not only want to prop their own history up by supporting the university, they want to prepare the way for the pathway for their own child to go to the same elite university and receive the same societal benefit. And of course, since I'm not part of that background, I can see that very clearly. It's a long pathway, but I think you're like me in that, you know, it's not true that the goal is to immediately, abruptly, just 180 degree change. It's that have an impact and improve the situation. I think your work is in exposing things is really been extraordinarily impactful, maybe even more impactful than you had hoped so quickly in your own eyes. I want to touch on something that is a little bit off of this, and that is the concern, the attention being paid to artificial intelligence now, because I see the flow of information has been completely perverted by intent by the people in journalism, in the media, and of course, bald-faced lies by people in power in the United States as well as elsewhere. But now we have this other variable here. which is AI, which is creating information that looks very legitimate. And I wonder, is there a discussion and what is the thinking going on inside journalism, inside the newsrooms, the reporters on this? Because this is a real potential problem.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't really affected my job in any direct way, but I will say this, like you, I share the skepticism of quote-unquote misinformation studies and attempts to regulate disinformation on social media. But I also think sometimes critics of that worldview fall into a kind of Pollyannish dream thinking that, oh, well, we'll just, you know, no censorship and then the best ideas will win out. It'll be great. I mean, there actually is a lot of just flat-out false information that circulates online, and unfortunately, some people do believe the false information. And I'm sure AI is going to compound that problem. And in fact, one of my worries is that it will compound the problem so much that demands for censorship of various kinds will grow.
Yes, I think this is a huge issue, really, because it's not to me. Okay, I'm opposed to the censorship completely, because there is no one to be trusted to be the censor. But something has to be done to make sure that what you're seeing is valid. I'm concerned about AI being used to make something look like it was said by someone, to make some news item, to make something said, you know, false, that it seems to be written by someone. I mean, this is, it looks very authentic. It looks real. I mean, that's, we've seen all these examples, and I'm wondering if these disclaimers have to be the way to go. Not a disclaimer, but a warning label, sort of like what we see on food or what we see on cigarette packs, that, you know, There are ways to say, okay, if this is artificial intelligence generated, maybe it has to be labeled as such, and it's criminal to not label something as such. I don't know. I haven't thought this through, but I do see a world rapidly coming where fake news, that I think Donald Trump coined that phrase, is now really literal, and in that sense, at some point, dangerous, because it's fraudulent and it's visibly spoken by someone, it's visibly written by someone in their words with their voice and their accent.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's going to be a problem, and not even just in journalism. There's already these fake ransoms, right, where you can basically scammers will take audio of a parent's child and make the parent think that the child is being held hostage, when of course that's not true. It's just that it's been generated with AI.
Absolutely.
That kind of thing.
I think this
scary.
Is something that journalists, media and journalists, they have to be at the table here in discussing this, because you know, the way it works is that journalism, news, media, that is the way information is disseminated. We need to have ethical journalism. We need to have truth in journalism. We need to have facts and debate. And the answer is not censorship, but we need to know that something is at least said by the people who are purported to have said it.
Right.
I wonder if this is sort of the new frontier in what journalism should be, you know, should be concerned with. It's not just exposing issues. It's how the pathway of information gets to the public.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that the way to go with this is you focus less on fact checking particular claims, but just on a kind of verification, like what you're saying. And in fact, I think AI might be useful for that, right? AI could be used to verify whether a video has been was made with AI or doctored in some way or not. That I think is as far as it should go. I mean, to me, that's probably the sweet spot. It's just verification. But the moment you go beyond determining whether Joe Biden really said X or Y and start getting into, was Joe Biden's claim true? Obviously, there are clear-cut cases where, yes, the claim is true or false. But in so many of these cases, the fact checks are really narrative checks. And I could be trusted to do those narrative checks. I don't know. But I think generally journalists as a class have not proven themselves to be particularly trustworthy, especially mm-hmm. since 2020. So, you know, I worry that this kind of AI disinformation dystopia is going to actually give journalists a lot of power to go beyond just kind of verifying that a video is real and start enforcing narrative even more than they already are. And that's right. Concerning.
So let's just sort of talk a little bit about your view on what's going to happen. What do you, you know, we for years, I think, have seen the decrease in use of traditional print media and news, what seems to be a desire for short snippets and excerpts and one sentence tweets to get your news, which I think is okay. I mean, that's part of what we do as a society, but I also think it's not enough. Obviously. I wonder if you feel in your short career so far that you're seeing a change in that. Has there been a change, a little bit more interest in getting some in-depth background, longer version, readers actually reading the entire article rather than a single sentence tweet, or we're not quite at that stage yet?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think that the trend is towards smaller and more economical bites of information or disinformation, as the case may be, blasted to everyone's computer through social media. Look, I think that long form journalism is important. I don't think it's going to go away entirely. There is a market for it. Look at the success of Barry Weiss's The Free Press. She'll publish long investigative features and people read them. Of course, they find out about them often through social media, but sure,
right.
People do read it. You know, there's also a question here as to what kind of audience you're talking about. Certain publications cater to more elite audiences, and I think those elite audiences will always exist and always demand more in-depth reporting and longer form print material. But the elite audiences are not the majority of people. They're not the majority of the citizenry. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not super optimistic in the near term that it's going to get better.
Have you been last? Let's finish up with sort of looking ahead in young people coming into the field. I think you know. It's obvious to me you're really a shining light in young journalism, which I'm hoping is an inspiration for more people. I bumped into you here on campus, and you were speaking at an event where there are young people who are interested in journalism. And tell me how that's going, and what kind of activities are you involved in to get more and more people who are ethical and smart to go into journalism?
Yeah, so the thing I was doing in Palo Alto is actually a good example both of the potential for young conservative journalism, but also the pitfalls of it and the limitations, right? Because there were, I don't know, maybe like 30 people at most at this conference, college student journalists. And, you know, some of them were doing pretty good work and were impressive. But the reality is, again, it's a pipeline problem. There aren't that many people showing up to these things in the first place. Of those who do show up, frankly, there's obviously a variation in how good people are. Yeah, you might be seeing a little more interest. But in terms of the people who are going to really be breaking scoops and doing serious investigative stuff, there's still a long way to go before we're even close to competing with the left for that. In terms of what I'm involved in, right, you know, when people ask me to speak at stuff like this, I tend to say yes, because I feel a certain duty to nurture the next generation, and I want there to be more people like me. I also hope that just by doing good work, that inspires people. But look, like, these are structural problems, and you know, before you were saying that there are plenty of talented people on the right overall, it's a matter of getting them to go into journalism. That's true, but it's also true that on the left, you have a much wider pool overall of just talented people, period, right? Because if you look at the elite universities that are churning out elites, they're overwhelmingly liberal, some of which is due to cancel culture, anti-conservative discrimination. But I think a lot of it has to do with deeper psychological and political things, and just for whatever reason, elite producing institutions tend to be dominated by left-wing people now. And I don't think that that's all a function of discrimination. I think there's a deeper psychological and political and economic story at play there. And until that changes, you know, conservatives are always going to be at an disadvantage, when they're trying to form kind of countervailing institutions to the dominant left-wing ones. I think the Federalist Society is pretty unique, right? There is no Federalist Society equivalent in media or even quite in finance, right? No one has built that yet.
Right. Well, the Global Liberty Institute Rising Leaders Program is intended to develop critical thinking young people who are in early careers to become leaders and be confident that they won't be canceled and have liaisons to people who are in senior positions. And I think it's a process. But of course, and I know you won't give up and I don't give up, because it's too important, if for no other reason than the truth matters. And I don't want to live in a country or a society where that stops being true. So let's end it there. And we keep working hard. Aaron, thanks for taking the time today. You're doing great work. And we need more Aaron Cybariums. I agree with that statement.
Thank you so
much,
Scott.
Good talking to you. Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Aaron Cybarium, check out his reporting at the Washington Free Beacon. Follow him on Twitter or X. His Twitter handle is @AaronCybarium. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as Spotify, Google, Apple, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts these days. And I'll see you next time.